right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. We're here with the second in our epic series of six podcasts that were funded by you, the listener, and pulled Zilpha and I out of retirement. So you're welcome. Tonight we have another great panel assembled. Dare I say, no, I won't say it. To my left, we have Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
And returning this, how many, Brian, how many podcasts have you done?
I've lost track. Four or five now, I think.
Okay. Returning in his triumphant glory is the one and only Brian Jolly.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure to be here. And unmasked. The man, the myth, the legend, one of the people I'm asked about most often from his appearance on Mormon Expression. And you say it's giving you some fame and notoriety, right?
I guess mild, yeah.
This is Dustin, a.k.a. Joe, the
artist formerly known as Joe.
The artist formerly known as Joe, Joe the Jehovah's Witness. And, you know, we had that podcast early on, wasn't it? It was in the first year or so.
I think it was in the 90s.
And then, you know, one of my favorites when you reviewed Conference for us.
Fun times.
Have you watched Conference since?
No, I can't say that I have. Just doesn't grab
you probably
me.
Didn't
the red
miss
chairs.
Much.
The red chairs didn't do it for you.
It was a little too eerie for me to go back. So it was too similar, reminding me of things.
We Dustin and I oftentimes have weird offs. Where we try to out-weird the other one with religious elements to see which is the stranger. Sometimes Dustin wins, but sometimes I win.
Yeah, we have the whole underwear thing going for us. That's a pretty strong card.
But they do have shunning, which is a pretty big
that's
trump
brutal.
Card. Yeah, yeah. But you do get a drink.
I do, yeah. That's a little bonus.
Yeah, but they don't get birthdays.
But the women do have to cover their head when they speak in church, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, if they're just, like, doing a demonstration, they don't, and they don't teach in church, but if they're teaching another, like, an investigator or, like, somebody who's studying to become a Jehovah's Witness.
And that woman's going to be like, oh, yeah, I want to join that church.
Yeah, if a baptized male is there, they have to have their head covered, like, with a scarf. Wow.
But if an unbaptized male...
Then they can do it. So before I was baptized...
So, like, you basically turn into God when you get baptized.
Basically, yeah. When I was 14, once I got baptized, like, anytime my mom was praying or doing anything, like, teaching somebody else, she had to wear a head covering.
In your home.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Awesome. Religions are awesome. All right. Well, I've been meaning to do a podcast on Joseph Smith and Joseph Campbell for a long time. Still haven't done it, and I'm still not doing it tonight. But we are going to dip our foot in the pool of Joseph Campbell. And tonight we're going to talk about the ex-Mormon epic journey as the hero's journey or the hero's quest. Or as Wikipedia tells me, it's called the monomyth.
I like that.
So last week, which you guys haven't heard because we haven't published it yet, but last week... I recorded a podcast. We sort of bagged on ex-Mormons for quite some time. And so I thought I would...
I don't know if we bagged on ex-Mormons. We were just like, woe is me. Being an ex-Mormon ain't that easy.
It was kind of a downer, and we kind of threw ex-Mormons under the bus a little bit. We said it wasn't all roses and sunshine.
Aren't
you guys ex-Mormons?
And unicorn farts and stuff.
I do not think we threw ex-Mormons under the bus, but that was not my perception.
Well,
of
if
that.
You're part of going under the bus, it's not necessarily as bad.
Right. Party under the bus.
So the journey out of the church to the other side is not that fun, actually. Truth be told, it is a very difficult journey. And it's one of those things that when you look back, like climbing a big mountain, you say, geez, that was a long haul. And sometimes until you have that perspective and see how difficult it is, I've told many people, and some don't believe me, that I take no pleasure in trying to get people out of the church. I've met ex-Mormons who say, you know, I've pulled 100 people out of the church, and the journey is difficult and it's painful, And there is it's the hero's journey, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. And if people take their first step in on that path, then I'm happy to help. But I wouldn't push anybody down that path. If people are happy in the church, they should stay in the church. And I think I said that last week too.
Yes.
All right.
So you didn't throw them under the bus.
Well, that's more like the members of the church, and I'm granting that too. So let's talk a little bit about the hero's journey. What Joseph Campbell pointed out in his book The Hero with a Thousand Faces is that there is a unifying factor to our myth, and you see the same stories over and over and over again, and they have the same elements. It's kind of like chiasmus, right? Once you're looking for it, you'll see it everywhere. And this is one of the reasons that even though George Lucas is a shitty scriptwriter, people love Star Wars, because what he was able to do with Star Wars Episode 4, the first one he did in 77, was he was able to regurgitate this myth, this mythos that's been with us for a long time. And I don't say that just because it's all proof that we actually descended from the same people who... we all descended from Adam and Eve, right?
There was an actual real start to the myth.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, apologists will tell you that the reason there's a flood myth all over the world is because it actually happened, right? I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that this is something that is common to human experience, and something that people go through again and again. It's just something that is like the cycle of life. I don't know. I don't want to imbue it with any supernatural powers, the hero's journey.
Well, it's the idea that there's more to life than our sort of mundane day-to-day. It's easy to fantasize about something outside coming in and affecting us and giving meaning where it's really hard to find it on your own.
And who doesn't want to be a hero or fantasize about being a hero?
Well, and I think the core of the myth, the monomyth, is that things are hard. I mean, that's what it boils down to. Like, people, if you see somebody who can play the fiddle really well, we tend to minimize the number of just bazillions of hours that they spend doing that. That. In our culture today, we see mastery come up on Star Search, or I guess I'm dating myself, on
American Idol.
American Idol, thank you. Thank you for the more current pop culture reference. So we see
that one's like 10 years old now.
Yeah. X Factor.
So we see that, and or there was a while, Cirque du Soleil used to have a television series on Canadian television. And you can watch it, and they had episode after episode.
It's really, really cool.
It's really fascinating to watch. But after a while, you start at first, it just blows you away. Then after a while, it's like, oh, they're doing the same shit everybody else does. But you don't realize that represents like literally thousands and thousands and thousands of tedious effort to get to that point.
You know, pretty much one in a million who get to the point where they can perform in Cirque du Soleil.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think also in our culture, we have this... delusion that you're born with talent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. It's earned through a lot of hard work. Even if you are talented in a certain area, there's still a load of work that's there.
Well, it's also emotionally safer to say, oh, you're so talented, rather than you clearly are willing to work way harder than I am.
Yeah, and when you find success anymore, you know, you do have that talent. You know, like there's some people that just because of the shape of their throat and their vocal cords, they will never be an amazing singer. But
there's some people that because of the shape of their tongue, they're just naturally good at certain things.
That's true.
we just changed the direction pretty radically.
Like, you didn't have to practice very much.
All right,
came naturally.
I'm blushing. Okay. So let's talk about the hero's journey. I think Campbell breaks it down into like 17 things, but according to Wikipedia, there is some other formulation that breaks it down into these 8 stages. I'm going to give an overview of them first, and then we can kind of talk about where we're getting with the ex-Mormon journey. Heroes, be they Hercules or Luke Skywalker or Rocky Balboa, start at a position of lowness, of the mundane, since we're talking about a sacred journey here. They are regular. They're undifferentiated. Even though there oftentimes there's a spark inside them. There's this
Buddha was more special to start out with.
We can talk about how Buddha goes through the same journey, but the Buddhists turn it somewhat on its head. So then there is a call, and oftentimes the hero will resist the call, but there's something external that touches the spark. Now, in every violent revenge film, the spark is that the hero's wife and kids are killed, right? In children's novels, the spark is that their parents are knocked off. Mm. There's obvious reasons for that spark. You have to clear out the mundane. You have to get rid of what compels you into the normal world, what keeps you in the rut. So if you have children in a novel and they have parents, doesn't make for a very good story because parents go in and solve problems for kids. You must force the heroes on their own journey. So there is the known world. So we have that call to adventure. And then there is the journeying out of the known world. And if you think about something like The Lord of the Rings, you know, they literally go into the forest. But they don't.
Literally.
Yeah, no, they literally go into the forest. They literally go into the unknown.
Paul Florian totally counts.
See, now everybody's got me all shaky. I've always used the word literally correctly, but now I'm even questioning myself on it. So you know, you go out into the world where it's cold and dark and strange, and there's strange faces and oftentimes strange languages, and you're just confronted. And in Greek mythology or in like movies of supernatural, there'll be a quick run into something that's spooky and crazy and different, you know, to mark that space between the unknown and the known. And in Tolkien, isn't it the Brandywine? Isn't that the river they cross?
Oh, yeah.
And then they go into and they meet Tom Bombadil.
Oh yeah,
which they cut out of the whole movie, which is the best part of the book.
Only one who read the novels would know that one.
Yes.
So for a hero like Jesus, I'm trying to think of what that would have been.
So Jesus is called out of Galilee. He was a carpenter. He was a commoner. And then he goes into the desert as his first thing and fasts for 40 days. So he has the supernatural. He has that call that forces him in the desert. And there he confronts the devil.
Okay.
So that is the threshold between the known and the unknown. And it sends him on that hero's quest.
I was just thinking about Karate Kid, actually, as an example. The kid, Ralph Macchio, grows up in New Jersey, and then he's forced to follow his mom out to California. That's his push out of his familiar, and it was something rather mundane. It was just a move rather than, you know, killing off his parents.
Right, and the hero, to show that they're not arrogant or that they're not, you know, like willfully putting themselves above us, is usually reluctant. The hero doesn't want to, you know, Rambo does not want to go back to Vietnam. You know, the hero is always reluctant to go on his journey.
Yeah, it helps to identify with the hero when they do that.
Right. But that's only the first obstacle is the what's called in the I'm really bad at French. Cousineau is it the second stage he calls the road of trials. And oftentimes during this stage, they'll be met with a helper. They'll be a guardian. Joseph Smith has Moroni during this second stage. And the guardian will help them through and pass them along in that.
Right. So his call to adventure was the sacred grove.
Yes, right? Yes. He's mundane. He's a farmer. He's there. And then he receives this special calling. And he's reluctant, right? They always have their prophetic role or their role of their hero thrust upon them. So there'll be challenges and there'll be temptations. And to, you know, to use the Christ example, there's specifically those temptations. When the Buddha is leading up to the Bo tree, you know, he faces these temptations that normally they face, and then he rejects all that and everybody deserts him. And then right before he's in the enlightenment, and then the devil Maya. No, is it my I can't remember. My Bali is rusty. Mm-hmm. Specifically, tempts him with sex and with food and with power, just like with Jesus in the desert.
Yeah, but what's weird about him is, doesn't he eventually say, "Hey, all that stuff is great. It's fine. Enjoy the happy Buddha, the big fat happy Buddha."
Well, oftentimes our hero runs into tricksters in this phase. People who are trying to throw them off the true path, either to the left or to the right. You have to remember, we've adopted in Western culture this Zoroastrian black and white model, but in most cultures, it's there's more this kind of straight and narrow, and you can go this way and you can go that way. So, you know, in Buddhism, you know, it would be, you can go too far into asceticism and reject everything, or you can go too far into, you know, hedonism or whatever, but we're looking for the middle way, which is the cessation of desire. So the hero path is oftentimes the middle way, and early Mormonism actually was very much that way. You know, Joseph Smith said things like that. You know, he liked the ladies, and some ex-Mormons fault him for that, but I think that's one of his more endearing qualities, right? Because the ladies, in Joseph Smith's defense, the ladies never said much negative about him. And even to the old women in Utah, they swore by him. They would still swoon into their 80s.
It's the rock star syndrome.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. So we have these challenges and these temptations that are pushing them along. You know, and if you watch like Clash of the Titans, the new one, you know, he's always resistant. You know, he doesn't want to be a god. He doesn't want to be a demigod. And he's going to face these things on his own. And then we reach sort of the pinnacle. This Phil Cuisineau one is called the Vision Quest. In the little diagram they have on Wiki, they call it the Abyss. You're going to face down your darkest trial, and that is when we have the symbolic death and rebirth. Siddhartha died under the bow tree, and the Buddha was born. Jesus dies on the cross and is resurrected as the Savior.
Ooh, what about the Beast? Beauty and the Beast, when he dies and then he's literally resurrected magically?
Yeah, yeah. and you oftentimes there's this quest like in Zoroastrianism, Mazda Huru? Or is that the god? I don't know. The hero goes and he goes through all these trials, and then he has this moment of revelation, this moment of bestowal of knowledge, and that oftentimes is accompanied by this overwhelming sense of peace, this overwhelming sense of clarity. And in this formulation, step four is the meeting with the goddess. So at that point, one beholds the divine. One arrives at the truth. So you've gone through this trial of increasing trials until the dark night of the soul, the worst trial in which one emerges triumphantly as the hero. And at that point, on the cycle, the transformation and the atonement. One is purged of all of their past transgression. All that was done wrong is eliminated. And then we move back from the unknown, from the other, to the mundane world. And one returns with a gift.
A superpower.
A superpower that can be bestowed upon humankind. Salvation. Intelligence
that can be used to help others.
Right. So one returns to the threshold, and oftentimes it is to return to slay a large beast. That the town or the village is being plagued by a dragon. The hero goes off on this journey as a mundane individual, receives their superpower, comes back and slays the dragon,
or shoots the thing in the Death Star.
Yeah, in Lord of the Rings, I think the chapter's called Purging of the Shire, where they show up and the bullies are like hanging out. They've been bitch-slapping everybody.
Right.
And these other hobbits show up, and they're armed, and they're much larger than the rest of the hobbits, and just dispatch with the baddies.
Right. Where you have the redemption after the redemption after redemption. And then the final stage is the mastery of two worlds. The hero will return to live in the world. And, you know, like... In The Lord of the Rings. At that point, the Wanderer, whatever his name is, what's the guy with the broken sword? The king.
Aragorn.
Yeah, so he's going to live a long time as triumphant king. They lived happily ever after, but the hero now has mastery of both the sacred and the mundane, and the hero can call that down and do as he will. Now, at that point, the story's kind of over. It's not really interesting. We sometimes wait for the once and future king, right? The myths of King Arthur have him returning to finally restore England to order. The myths of Jesus have him coming down and punishing all the baddies. And we have the same thing in we're waiting for the 10th avatar of Vishnu in Hinduism. We're waiting for in Islam. We're waiting for the final ass kicking, right? Because we're still stuck in that known world with these beasts, and we need the hero to come purge us.
So at first we said we fantasize about being the hero, which I think that's part of it. And the other part is we know how weak we are, and we need a hero. We need a savior.
Yeah, I think in all good myth, the powers are always beholden to a greater power, right? I mean, that's why Empire Strikes Back is such a compelling movie, because you take and have the ultimate bad guy. He is a walking black dick, a big black caped cock walking around, and he is going to
helmet.
He's going to show you little white cocked men who is in charge. And what do we see when he finally gets back in the thing? That he is bowing before his master, and that is the end of George Lucas's command of myth. To that point, it all goes down. All right, so that's the hero's journey.
What does that have to do with?
Any thoughts on the hero's journey?
That's a pretty good recap.
All right, it's one of those things. Like I said, like Joseph Campbell, once you see it, you're going to see it everywhere, at least to some degree or another.
Yeah, it doesn't have to have every single step that Joseph Campbell pointed out in order to sort of fit the mold.
Yeah, I definitely think our culture wants that, though. I mean, we crave it. I mean, for thousands of years, we've been wanting that, but now only we're craving it, but it doesn't really fit with the whole logical world of knowledge that we have now.
Well,
we still want help from above.
Yes, but that might be one reason why we've turned to things like Star Wars and Batman and Spider-Man and fantasy. Known fantasies that we can still enjoy, you know.
But,
idealization of human.
Kind. Well, I think one of the elements to control people, because I think there's a compulsion to go on the hero's journey yourself. And I think, like in some Native American cultures, you know, there was the vision quest that they would say, you need to go on your own hero's journey. And in some religions, they have that. You need to be converted. You need to have your own conversion.
It's sort of like a mission.
Well, the Rumspringa is what I was thinking.
Yeah, the Amish Rumspringa.
For the Amish. But there's you know, and I wish I commanded Protestant theology better, but some Protestant churches, I think as a Baptist, you have to sort of show a manifestation of this receiving the Spirit of God. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. You know, obviously it's not going to be really super miraculous, but you have to
shake,
go through that.
Wiggle.
So what we often have to do to control people in bigger cultures is we externalize the hero's myth. We externalize the hero's journey. And so you don't need to find redemption. You need to be redeemed. We have the Redeemer. And what you need to do is just follow our 12-step program. and then you're going to be redeemed. We're gonna sell it to you. We're gonna give it to you.
You don't have to go on a hero's journey.
No,
somebody else already did.
Right. The Death Star has been destroyed for you.
You just have to believe it.
Make your checks payable to.
So I think there's some of us out there in the world. And I'm not just talking about people who leave religion. I think there's people who join the military for this reason. There's people who become artists. There's people who seek all kinds of endeavors because the mundane doesn't do it for them. There's something off. There's something wrong. There's something plastic about the world. Something's just not quite right. And right now I'm thinking about
Matrix.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, or, you know, where Arthur in the beginning, something's just off. Like things are just askew, and of course, then the world gets blown up. But there's going to be something that's off, and there's that call. So I think for many of us, and I've posited before that it might be a defect. I want to reemphasize why Dustin's here as not having anything to do with Mormons except that you live in Utah.
Woo-hoo.
That this thing is universal. This is not something that the Mormons own. But for most of us, we received this call. There was this inkling. Because if you ask people why they left the church, they say, well, I found out this stuff about polygamy, or I was not happy in church, but they're still begging a question. There was a spark.
It's like the short circuit that happens in Invention of Lying. Like, he just had something go wrong. Like,
oh, yeah, Richard Lace's character.
Kind of like a defect. Like, oh, mm-hmm. For some reason, we questioned it, and we went down that road.
Because you're not supposed to question it.
Right.
And most people don't.
Right.
Especially when you take the long view, evolutionarily. You know,
you're really not supposed to question your in-group.
And you wouldn't. And most people don't. They just it doesn't cross their mind. It's maddening when you talk to, you know, we talk about who are the greatest number of people in Utah. It's Jack Mormons. And they're maddening people to talk to because they're staunch defenders of the faith, but they don't
they do all the bad things.
Yeah, yeah. Because you don't question the values.
Oh, I just said the quote bad things.
Yeah, the quote bad things, yeah.
Well, they question, I guess, I'm not very intimate with any Jack Mormons, but is the idea that they don't want to do it, or they feel like they can't live it, or...
No, they still believe it, but they just don't want to, doesn't fit their life.
They feel like they can't, I'm just not good enough, I've already made too many mistakes. I mean, it's all true, but so I have to throw in the towel.
Some of them are kind of universalists.
Like they feel like they can't do it.
I think so.
Or they don't need to, they're not as compelled to, you know, they think, I've talked to some and think, well, Jesus loves everybody, you know, mm-hmm. He's going to forgive me for these things, mm-hmm. It's not a big deal. In a sense, the people who go to church religiously are the loonies, right? Because the great majority just never takes any of this crap too seriously, right? Like
I was a loony.
The majority of people
aren't
will go
we
to of yeah. Well, yeah, that's part of our problem. That's probably the heroes. The great majority of people will go on the 4th of July and wave flags on the watch the parade go by. It's a minority of people that actually get on the floats, right? But unfortunately, those are the people usually calling the shots, right? But because the rest of us are like, yay, America! All right, let me go back to the.
I got some fireworks.
Weenies on the, you know, and so we all started. Those of us who left religion, we were on the floats, but because the guys on the side, they were just in their lawn chairs having a good time. So you kind of have to start from this for the hero. It was this point of mundane, but being called. And for, I think, those who, like, leave religion, there's this sense, this call comes from the sense of that something is not quite right, and then a compulsion to do something about it.
Yeah, that is like the Matrix.
Yeah, that compulsion in the church, certainly for me, came from the idea that had been drilled into my head since I was a tiny kid about being honest, telling the truth, even when it's hard. And when things started to unravel, I mean, that was the pushing element is, wow, I can't stand up there and say I believe these things when I don't. I feel compelled.
Right, and that pushed you on. A lot of people describe, they'll be reading some book and they'll hit just some random fact. And that is the threshold between the known and the unknown. And it's interesting to see how much, you know, in a lot of these myths, there are the demons that we hinted at this before, who will try to protect the hero from seeing the hero's potential. And if you look at something like the churches, how much they do to manage their own message, how they control the Sunday school lesson and what's available in the magazines, and they just exert such control over that to keep people from going on that hero's journey. And
well, yeah, that's why organizers have to condemn apostates so badly. Don't talk to them. They're evil, bad. They're unhappy. It's because they know exactly where the parts in the curtains are to look behind. Like, it's too easy to reveal flaws in the system. They're everywhere.
Right. Well, once you see them, once you cross into the unknown and you start, first of all, you're going to be like shocked and horrified by these things you're discovering. And we tend to talk about it on an intellectual basis. An emotional basis is just as valid of a path. There can be things you start seeing, and there's the people who leave the church for emotional reasons as well as intellectual reasons. They see abuse. They see corruption. They see people suffering. So to them, it doesn't necessarily matter that, you know, like the Doctrine and Covenants is full of nonsense and lies. To them, it matters that people are suffering from ecclesiastical abuse. These are both valid points, but yeah. There comes a point when they leave the church as being, you know, God or whatever behind.
Yeah, it's like if you had a gay child, and you know your kid's a good, decent person who just happens to have a different attraction than society's used to, and then the church hates on them, tells them that they're not worthy of God's love. That's dissonance right there. Say, wow, this kid is absolutely worthy of love, and they're saying he's not. That's really horrible. I want to distance myself from this horrible.
So that's the call to adventure. So that call to action, and then the next step is that crossing that threshold. And it's amazing, you meet a lot of NOMs, New Order Mormon, sort of liberal Mormon people, yeah. who have that call, and they walk to the abyss, into the unknown, and then they back up. They do not dare take that leap. They do not dare walk out into the unknown because there's monsters out there, right?
It just blows my mind. I can't get to that point and walk away from it. It's, yeah.
So some of us feel compelled to, you know, we see that door in the unknown. Some of us just bust through it. Others, I've seen, sit at that threshold for years and years and years and eventually walk back. There are people among us who know all sorts of stuff about the church, who have gay children who have suffered, but just cannot let it go. They can't walk into the unknown. They can't go on their hero's journey. And it's tough.
Yeah, It's tragic. I mean, every story is different. People have their reasons for not doing it. And sometimes they feel trapped, right? Sometimes they feel like it's the lesser of two evils to stay where they are and not go that extra step, because what if it ruins their marriage, or they've got a career path that they're sort of stuck in. It's extraordinarily disruptive. I don't blame anyone for being frightened at that threshold.
And oftentimes in the hero's journey, the hero will lose all the tools that they have come with. They'll usually get granted a boon, but they will slowly lose all their, you know, all their mates. Their boats will crash. The siren song will get them, or whatever, until they're stripped down, you know,
naked.
Yeah. All of Buddha's followers will desert him. So as one starts going through this journey. In the first stage, and one is discovering and one is seeing things going on that were hidden before them, they begin to suffer a lot of loss, and they begin to question even their values, because they've left behind the old mundane world, and oftentimes things will push at them that make them abandon those values, or they'll push those values on their own, because a lot of the values were corrupt. They were there to control the hero.
Yeah, you really have to rediscover everything, because your whole world is flipped. And so on that journey, you have to question all your values, all your morals, everything all over again.
Yeah, certainly in the Mormon Church, you've got this toolkit that's right in front of you. You've got your scriptures, and you've got prayer, and you've got fasting, and you've got faith, and you've got the spirit of discernment and the Holy Ghost to guide you. And when you don't believe that stuff anymore, like, that's the toolbox you spent your life developing, and oh, prayer's all in my mind, and I have to find the answers myself, and then I wanted to cringe, because there's no helper out there. It was my imagination the whole time. That's both good and bad. I mean, that the answers have been in me all along, but the toolbox I had developed was full of useless tools.
Mm. And it's scary to make all those decisions yourself.
Oh yeah,
and there's going to be mistakes. You know, in all good myths, there is a lot of blood that is spilled.
Yeah,
it's necessary. There needs to be a bloody sacrifice. Because. When things are easy, when things are handed to you, it's Satan's plan, right? There's no risk, there's no reward, and it's amazing that myth still exists, you know, in like the Mormon Church, but they're reproducing it almost verbatim. You know, they want to close off the choices until it's become a doctrinal this new thing that's developed over the last 50 or 60 years of maintaining your freedom by not exercising it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, war is peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
That is phenomenally Orwellian.
Yeah, yeah. And it really comes in who I think is a brilliant theologian, Boyd Packer. He comes to that over and over again. He can give you real justification for the Mormon backing away from choice, that I was with some coworkers at lunch today at the Panda Express, and that you know they were talking about this movie. One of them had gone and seen the Lincoln movie, and what was the first question that was asked?
What was it rated?
Exactly. It not was it good? Not was it worthwhile? Not did it bring benefit to your life? It was what was it rated? Because that is Satan's plan. That is the walls that are going to keep you in the known world and keep you from going on a journey. Because a journey involves possible pain and possible discovery, both of which are enemies to the mundane.
And again, the decision was made for you. You didn't have to decide whether you wanted to watch it or not because those are the rules.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And whereas now we want to decide, I mean, there are some movies we don't want to watch, but we're deciding that.
So what do the witnesses think about rated R movies?
You can't watch them.
Oh,
but
really?
It doesn't mean that some people do watch them.
Uh-huh. Well, that's how Mormons.
Yeah, it's like some people watch. Oh, well, it's Schindler's List, so we can watch
it's really
it. You know,
a good,
or sometimes like, I mean, there are
Saving Private
too,
Ryan,
sure.
Or was that maybe that was PG-13? That was R.
I went on a rated R binge after I left watching all the rated R movies that I didn't get to see growing up, like those, Rambo and things like that everybody else has seen.
Those threads will come up routinely on the boards, like, hey, what are some good rated R movies to watch? And there's a standard list of, I don't know, probably 50 movies that people say, you got to see all.
That's a really bad rated R. If you're going to dip your toe in, that's like full on rated R. But
well, there's some rated R movies you just have to see so you get cultural references. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
You have to see The Godfather. You have to see Fast Times at Ridgemont High. You know.
Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Sort of like drinks, too. I mean, if you've never ever tasted alcohol, you miss out on a lot of our culture and the references made all over the place in movies. And
that's the exact same with me with holidays. Like the same with the drinks for you guys is for me for holidays because I've had drinks for the whole time. But
yeah, you finally got to see Trick or Treating this year for the first time.
Did you actually go trick or treating?
I went trick or treating.
Oh, yeah. Fun.
I didn't go to the doors. I
it's
walked.
Probably
along
not
with
as
Brian.
Thrilling as a 30-year-old.
Get out of here.
He was on his knees, but they weren't buying it. The beard is such a tell.
Did you extract your daddy tax? I mean, if you went with him, you got to get the parent tax. You didn't tell him about the parent tax?
10%.
You get to pick the best piece of candy out of his
No,
of his
he
thing.
Also didn't see the part where we go through each piece of candy and make sure it's not tampered with.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because of the
the razor blades.
There could be razor blades in the apples or whatever.
Yeah, so it was a lot like that for me. Like, I don't know anything about the holidays. I'm just kind of discovering. I know a little bit about it from culture, but that's just...
You decorated a tree just days ago.
Yeah, it's just the culture. I've seen on TV, just like you've seen alcohol on TV, but to experience it and do it yourself is totally different.
Right. And I think that's part of the transformation, but we're skipping the long dark night of the soul, which is important. People are going to hit rock bottom, right? And you know, something like the 12-step program is about redemption. Is about coming out of this darkness and this temptation, and oftentimes adherence to the 12 steps will say, no, you've got to hit absolute, you got to bottom out, and that's where this death and rebirth, you know, where Jesus asks, you know, in a moment of sorrow or whatever, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? You're ultimately alone. You're ultimately stripped naked, and one of the reasons I asked both of you to come on is you have both. Lost pretty much everything. You're both divorced due to faith.
It didn't help. I mean, losing my faith did not help the marriage I had.
Right, right. But as part of that journey of rediscovery...
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I just step on your point?
No. You're right. You're right. I don't mean to frame it as if, like, your divorce was the rock bottom
for
you.
It's fine. But,
all these things... just take away everything that you had that was of value before.
There's a bigger element, at least for me, in when I think about why people are so resistant to letting go of the idea of God. And it just my perspective on this is that growing up in the church and going through hard experiences and giving tithing and spending my vacation time on going to scout camp and doing this stuff, and then a little later... toward the end of my marriage where we had some miscarriages. Like, there's a lot of suffering that gets bound up in these ideas that there will be an explanation later, that God has a reason for doing this to me. And when I came to the conclusion that God was a human construct, it also meant not only the death of God and death of the theology, but the death of my sacrifices. They ceased to have meaning. All that heartache and all the bad stuff that I had put on God's lap to deal with it evaporated, and I felt just empty as could be.
I think to build on that, life is full of dead ends. I mean, we all, every one of us, make a lot of bad choices. And it's not just bad choice in, like, I shouldn't have eaten that. But it's bad choice, like, I just wasted 3 years at a job with sadistic assholes. Mm-hmm. And it messed up, it put my career behind, and it was a toxic place to work. And that's 3 years I'll never get back. Yeah. I just spent 5 years in a bad relationship. The relationship was toxic to everybody around. You know, I spent a lot of money. I spent thousands of dollars on a business venture that was all this is the normal things that people go through.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about being a churchgoer is you have this underlying sense of meaning in everything, cuz first of all what the religion, what in our mundane world will say is all that doesn't matter. That's all meaningless, because what really matters is that you go witnessing every Saturday. Yeah. What really matters is that you go do your temple work, that you pay your tithing.
Because the life after this is going to be the good part.
Right. Yeah, the life after will be the reward. So it, to your point, it gives meaning to all these failures.
But it also lets you say, well, God told me to take this job because I had a good feeling about it.
Right. There must have been something I
needed to learn from this.
Yeah, I agree. So I think oftentimes there comes a point where you're hanging on to all these different little theological elements. And even when one first leaves the church, now one might end up as a Methodist or whatever, but oftentimes there are these little like parachutes you have. And for a lot of people, the journey is slowly stripping that stuff away. Some people happens very quickly. Some people happens very slowly as all this stuff gets kicked out from underneath them. You know, and then they start having to question. And sometimes they'll even go through a phase when they're like, I don't even know what I want. I don't even know what I'm after anymore. And we have a podcast coming up in a couple weeks about that specifically with women. It's a very tough issue with women. But you'll reach the abyss. So you'll reach the end of your line. And for some people, this journey will happen while they're still going to church. You know, they'll keep going. For some people, they just walk out. So I'm not saying like there's this natural correlation between this and stopping going to church and hitting that bottom, that awakening.
It's a scary place to be out there without faith, without all the answers, like making all the decisions yourself, literally by yourself.
And especially when you've been told all your life that it is a scary place out there and that you will fail on your own.
So once we reach that darkest point, the bottom of the cycle, what in the myth has been happening is there's usually been some force out there, something supernatural or you know, a kernel or something that's pushing along that knows that you have that spark in you, because what the hero gains after he passes through that, after he goes through transformation, is the realization of his own strength, the realization that he can overcome, that he's not reliant. If you read the Greek myths, the demigods, you know, the offspring of Zeus, will learn that they can operate independent of the boons of the gods, that they have within them the divine spark, and they can overcome themselves, and they recognize their own power and their own
potential.
Will to power, to talk to our German friends.
What? I'm a little disturbed, though. There's a disturbance in the force. Yes. And it has to do with the fact that all of these heroes are men.
Men tend to do the hero's journey more often than women. I think it's a matter of biology. I think that women tend to be home with the kids a little bit more. But there's plenty of these sort of journeys. Who is it? Persephone with the three pomegranate seeds? You can find the same things with women. I've been using he because I'm a sexist bastard. But
there really aren't very many female heroes.
Not in the predominant culture that we've adopted. If you read Greek mythology, there's lots of them. In Eastern philosophy, there's many.
That's true.
And one can look at I'm thinking back. I was an anthropology major for a few years. One can think back to in a lot of cultures, the whole birthing cycle is a hero's journey.
Yeah, it's venerated.
It's a sacred experience and transformative. So
as it should be.
But I mean that's
yeah, no, it's a nod to her point. And women are definitely underrepresented in our narratives, or pop culture narratives.
Right, and I think that's where we're going to return in a couple weeks and talk about women's issues, especially with this journey and with the mm-hmm. we call it the women's midlife crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of it, is that lack of idealized role model, mm-hmm. you know, for the journey. Because I exhort you all to stop going to romantic comedies, because culturally what the myth with women is women are always validated when a man validates them. And stop showing that shit to your daughters, because
it's fairy tales are the worst.
Fairy tales are awful, and the romantic comedies are awful, and they're all that way. The woman is validated by a man's love. Okay, so we have our hero who goes through that. Twilight. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
Who goes through that transformation, and then the atonement, because the hero, and especially when we're outside of this Judeo-Christian ethic, it's not in the Old Testament, right? The Old Testament doesn't have any problem with its heroes having flaws. I don't know when we sort of fell into this, but it's definitely an American ideal.
Be like Jesus, right?
Yeah.
Be perfect.
Maybe it came from Christianity, but I mean, the Pauline stuff doesn't seem to have this element that much. I mean, Paul is a story of redemption. But, you know, like our myths in the United States, like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, these guys have to be free from any flaw. You know, it was the cherry tree. They were honest from the get-go. Mm-hmm.
It's our fear of failure, I think.
Yeah, it's the overzealousness of the American dream.
Well, I mean, our culture has equated mistakes with badness. If you make a mistake, you are bad. Well, our heroes can't have made mistakes then, or they would be bad. But they're heroes, so they're good. It's kind of circular.
This is a modern invention. You know, normally the hero's journey might involve, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And that's okay. But there needs to be atonement. The person needs to overcome those things. And I culturally, the person does not even have to give up their sins, but they have to be in charge of them. So if our hero is going to be sexual, they must not be like succumbing to
temptation,
the siren song. They have to willfully own it, right? But that is on the positive side, to talk about our metaphor, is when that transformation and atonement comes, it comes from that hero's journey, from those temptations that were overcome, from staring down the abyss. Then one has the moral agency. Dustin, you were saying it great, that when you're back in the mundane world, when you start, everything's told to you. But now you have to go out and you have to derive your own morality. You have to make those choices yourself.
Yeah, it's a scary place to be, especially when everything was told to you what you needed to do, where you needed to go, how you needed to do it. And now all the decisions you have to make yourself, and nobody's telling you that it's okay. Nobody's telling you that it's right and wrong. I mean, aside from like laws, but I mean, there's nobody guiding you. You're your own guide. It's a scary place to be.
Go ahead, Brian.
So part of what you find when you're in abyss, when you're in that moment of revelation, is that you have those tools. You have this lucidity. It's like, I can form myself from here. My old tools might not be working, but I can see a path to where I need to go and what I want to be. So I can be my own moral agent. I can determine what I'm comfortable with in terms of taking risks and kindness and integrity and honesty. And you find yourself like wanting to write that letter to your family that says, I'm not going to church anymore, but I'm still a good person. Or you find yourself admitting to yourself that you can't keep going to church, or you can't keep pretending to people that you are who you used to be.
Right. And I think that the word control is key. You know, if you think about like Star Wars or something like that, Luke Skywalker is battling the little bot with the lightsaber, and he learns his guide. You know, we've talked a little bit about the guides. Those were important. But the guide never does anything for you except show you your own internal thing. But the ultimate end is the control that the hero achieves. In the end, you know, Luke discovers his internal control and is able to shoot the balls of fire into the exhaust port or whatever. Yeah. So it's mastery, you know, and that's to look at Eastern religion, Eastern philosophy. There's very much of that one overcomes their desires, one overcomes their then they don't necessarily have to give it up. Like it's not that a Zen master is asexual or doesn't eat food or whatever, but he is in complete control over that. He can take it or leave it, and that is the matter of mastery. And I think when I've seen people who pass through this dark journey, you know, there's anger and there's bitterness and there's rage and there's destruction in their lives. There's things falling apart. There's sometimes barfing at the end of parties or waking up next to somebody who you sort of regret waking up next to. There's all these elements, but there's this emergence out the other side of this moral agency, of this ownership, of knowing I can choose to do this or not do that, but it's my choice.
Yeah, that's on me. The consequences too. And that's all right.
Yeah.
All we have is choices, and then we have results from those choices, good or bad. But,
yeah. But and
it's completely up to us.
Back to the religion. The religion would tell you, well, yeah, we told you so. You didn't have to go on this big, you know, dark journey to discover what was going to be good for you and what wasn't. We already knew it, and we told you it, and you didn't have to do that.
But the real when you... So from atonement comes reemergence into the mundane world. The religions do not want enlightened people. If you meet the Buddha in the road, kill it.
Right.
because the enlightened individual can look at Mormon doctrine and pull it apart and say, even if you accept it, you don't need the church. The church has no meaning. It's even in the scriptures, you know, that righteous people can baptize. Even if you accept the Abrahamic covenant, in my nod to Mike Tannehill or whatever, that none of that is predicated on the church. Like, it's predicated on righteous people or on people making right choices. But even short of that, if you accept the premise that the priesthood is the power that governs the universe, then, like, getting a PhD in physics is just as much a path to the truth as would be becoming a deacon or a teacher or a priest in the church. And the church does not want that belief. The church does not want people empowered. Because what religions do is they are peddlers of cures. And their interest is keeping everybody sick. Because they want everybody buying their medicine. And that's what they do. Oh, if you go, you'll see it. They're constantly telling you, you're flawed, you're sick, you're wrong, you're defective.
Yeah, I take it back. The first rated R movie you need to see is The Matrix, because that's basically it. Like right when he sees, you know, for what it is, and that's what they don't want him to see is the truth.
Right. Yeah, they don't want you to see that. I think in the way I would describe it is I see no sin, I see no guilt, I see only consequence.
Yeah.
So to like The Matrix, it's like the numbers coming down on my screen. You say, well, what are your morals? There are no morals. There is only consequence.
Right.
You know, and there's risk and there's result.
Yeah, there's kindness and compassion or cruelty.
So if someone says, well, should a teenager, so a 16-year-old, sleep with her boyfriend? There is no answer to that question per se, because there's only consequence. And the consequence of that action might be positive in one instance and negative in the other.
Right, and there's no blanket. There's no white blanket and there's no black blanket. You can't just cover something as good or bad.
Right.
Because there's nuance.
And oftentimes, and this is the hard part, and I think you were hinting at this, Dustin, is it's a mix. In the real world, there are always good and bad. And oftentimes the most difficult decisions we have to make, like divorce or careers or what you're going to study or things like that, they're in the fog. There's consequences we can't see, and you don't know how they're going to turn out. But owning that is what the hero's journey produces. So the ex-Mormons and the ex-Jehovah Witnesses and the ex-Baptists and the ex-evangelicals, what these people are is thoughtful. And in the last stage, they had on the what did we call it? Let me go back.
The return.
The mastery of two worlds. I really like this. There's a documentary. It's okay. It's kind of mediocre. Like Lord Protect Us from Your Followers.
Mm-hmm.
It's done by a kind of a liberal evangelical, if you can buy that, who's sort of taken aback. You know, this is at the height of the Bush years when the evangelicals were kind of at the pinnacle of their power.
There's
a spectrum in.
Yeah, he's
in
a Sunstone evangelical. but there's this great scene in there where they have this College Bowl like competition. Have you guys seen this?
Yeah.
Well, I think
yeah,
you've told us about it.
I think I've also told on the podcast before. But they get some pundits. These are like not like A list pundits. They're probably B or C list pundits. And they have some like atheists.
Well, I thought it was like the from Harvard or some good university.
Yeah.
They got some people from the atheist group there, and they got some of the students.
Some social liberals and atheists and some people on the left. And then they
evangelical
had some evangelicals. And what they did at this College Bowl is they had even questions. So they had questions on like biblical theology, and then they had questions on like science, like Darwinism and things like that. And the liberals mopped it up on both sides. They smashed the other team on both ends. They knew more about the Bible, and they knew more about like Darwinism, where the biblical folks knew quite a bit about the Bible. And I think it was close. The scores were really close, but they were dismal in the science. The thing that apologists really don't like about, especially like atheistic and secular ex-Mormons, is they reemerge having lived both lives. Mm-hmm. They have a command of both worlds.
They have a bigger toolkit.
Right. And what they will do then is attempt everything they can to marginalize and dismiss
science.
Your message. I'm thinking of Carl Sagan's Contact. In the movie, there's just one. There's just Jodie Foster. In the book, I think there's five of them that come back after going through this journey. And then, you know, the people who are vested in the status quo do everything they can to discount this knowledge that the people have received. They've gone on the hero's journey. They've come back with knowledge of both the mundane and the external. And everyone will try to say, you're crazy. This person is insane. They're a witch doctor. You can't trust them because they can move in and out of both worlds.
Yeah, that's right on. That's crazy. Because it's totally how I feel. Like, I understand the theological world really well, but then I've studied a lot more in the science world and the part that I ignored in the past.
And any one of us who have been through this journey, especially very thoughtfully, we could easily pass as a believer.
Oh, yeah.
Without any
piece of cake.
With not a flinch, you know. Because we know those thoughts and that train of thinking, so you come out as the person who has the full toolkit,
mm-hmm. Master of both worlds.
And you can stop bullets.
Wait,
Matrix. Sorry,
but what's ironic, and you see this in a lot of those stories, and you know, with the demigods or the whatever the people in the Matrix are, they can recognize one another. They know the other people who have mastered both worlds, but the mundane people cannot recognize them. They do not recognize the demigods.
It's true.
Because they have not passed through the hero's journey. But it's not the, you know, we talked about that divine spark, whatever that was. I'm sort of like the Buddha here. I believe that divine spark is in everybody. And maybe some of us were just fortunate enough to be able to follow that call.
Or unfortunate, whatever.
Or fell into it. Or.
But it's the hero's journey that transformed us. It's not that – and anyone could go on the hero's journey.
Yeah. You hear a lot of believers will be very defensive and say, oh, you think we're all a bunch of stupid sheep. And that's not really it. It's not about smarts. It's about having pursued that – have dared to go on that journey to find out.
On down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, it's not really about how your IQ. That's sort of irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it's irrelevant. Yeah, it's Plato's cave. It's that you have recognized the shadows, and because you have removed yourself from the seat, you've broken the chains, you can now see the difference between the shadows and the real world.
Yeah.
And it's the Zen koans. It's to break this illusion of the world, because we're trapped into that.
What's a Zen koan?
A koan is a little piece of prose or a thought that is designed to break you out of your standard ideas of thought. The most common one is so cliched it's almost not even worth mentioning, which is, what is the sound of one hand clapping?
Mm.
Right.
Okay.
It's the opposite of a thought-stopping cliche. It's a thought-starting cliche.
So idea behind a koan is it can cause instant enlightenment, instant karma. But of course, they don't work. What they are is trying to break you out of that modality of just of assumptions and thought. Now, can people fall back into that, or can people just transform one mundane world for another? Absolutely. And I think what's really interesting about this hero's journey is it, through our life, we're multifaceted, right? There are many hero's journeys that we have completed and emerged on the other side.
Yeah,
and
even for a woman, it's every month you have to go through this wallow
step
in the mire.
Out of the real world.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, you know, I'm kind of attacking religious folks. They have been on their own hero's journeys in many elements in their career or
yeah,
in their
family. Yeah, they can see this very thing in their own lives.
And some of them emerge in a different religion.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the scary part.
I was just thinking of Pioneer Trek all of a sudden. Like, that's sort of a forced hero's journey to reinforce the group loyalty. Wow.
Yeah, the treks that they have the youth
yeah,
go
Yeah, I mean, it fits, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
for sure.
You look at there's the threshold with the guardians. You got the helpers along the way, challenges and temptations. There's the abyss, transformation. And wow, it's like, wow, that's all bound
up. This is the temple, right?
That's amazing. Oh, yeah.
You know, you're in the known world. You know, you walk in, you're in your mundane clothes. You go into the dressing room, and from there you go and get your new name. You'll pass through a curtain. You're now dressed new. You have a new name. You've left out the unknown. You go through this trial of these challenges and temptations on screen. You know, in Adam and Eve, the devil comes and tempts you.
And then you
so
get
the abyss is getting kicked out of the garden.
Yeah, mean? You get kicked out of the Garden of Eden.
Then the climax of the movie is when Satan reveals that he has power, and some of this has been watered down. But Satan reveals that he has power over all of the clergy. That the clergy are operatives of Satan. And then at that point, Peter casts him out. And then that's the darkest point, and then you go through the transformation, and you end up in the celestial room. You end up in the celestial.
And you even
Dustin's looking at you like you're nuts.
You even change the side
that
your robe is on. Because
I did see the YouTube video, so I'm a little more familiar. Uh-huh. But yeah, it still sounds crazy, and it was crazy to watch.
But it's a hero's journey.
And you know, you can read, you know, in masonry, you know, the myth of Hiram Abiff, and you know, the idea of the way the temple does it is nothing new. It's nothing Mormons made up, you know.
But you want to know something, though, that we didn't, I don't think, mention yet, is this hero's journey, you might not end up coming out the other side. I mean, you could get stuck in the abyss, right?
Yeah, like we mentioned, a lot of people die. You know, when
yeah, or the wheels come off. Right? Yeah. You don't have the controls and stability of religious teachings, and then your life just kind of crumbles because you don't know how to handle your newfound freedom, and your old tools don't work, and you haven't figured out the new ones yet.
It could be that you start on this journey, and then you end your life, basically you die.
Right.
Your life falls apart.
Well, doesn't every dragon slayer, I mean, wasn't the last thing before he hits the dragon is he has to walk through a pile of bones. I mean, that's all the other heroes before him failed. You know, if you want to get Medusa's head, you're going to pass all the stone statues of all the heroes before you who didn't make it past that point.
And the believers really want to point those people out.
Well,
look at the dangers. See what happens? That's what happens.
Right, right. Yeah. The world is not a safe place. And I think that's what emerges out the other side is you realize that we talked this a minute ago. You have no safety net.
Yeah.
And
so if you can emerge, then in a way you are the hero, the conquering hero.
So if somebody
you'll be stronger because of it too, but it's a tough place to dig yourself out of.
Yeah. If you can face down alcohol or whatever and master it, so it doesn't control you. My beer is empty, by the way. There's a power in that. You know, there's a power to be able to take it or leave it. But 10% or whatever the number is of people who encounter that will become alcoholics.
Yeah.
And if one stretched this out to their own life, and when I was going down, that's not really one hero's journey. We're on many, many in different stages in our
life. Right. So just because you see someone in the wallowing in the mire, in the darkness, that doesn't mean that eventually they won't emerge some.
It doesn't mean that, and I think it also means that every adult that you meet is in the abyss in some aspect of their life all the time.
Yeah, because there's lots of mini hero journeys.
Right. So you might have conquered your religious thing, but your relationship is in the abyss.
Or maybe your fear of public speaking, and yet you have to do this thing for work, and that's your own hero's journey.
Right, right. And you know, we unfortunately, because of myth, you know, think the hero that conquers everything. I was just listening to an author talk about a biography of Winston Churchill. You know, here's a man who, you know, really probably deserves more credit for winning the war than any other person. But he was a dismal leader after that. Like his calling was the war. After that, he was awful, and he had lots of personal flaws and lots of personal problems. That is the real world hero. They have one area they conquer.
Well, isn't that kind of like Joseph Smith? I mean, and he sets up these communities, and he's really good at that. But then, you know, what happens in Nauvoo when, you know, all the shit hits the fan?
Right.
He's not good at every aspect of being a religious
leader. Absolutely. He's a human being. And where the Mormons keep getting into trouble is they want to turn him into a modern-day hero.
Yeah, with the Jesus, the Joseph in the crib at Christmas time, because that's Joseph Smith's birthday, too.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Right, it's at the we'll have to take a field trip down there. They have a Joseph Smith manger scene in the administration building of BYU every year. We'll go down there and take pictures
of
us in front of the – has the – You guys don't know that?
Yes.
Wow, I've never heard of this.
There's a crib.
If you go into the main admin building, there's a little. They set up a little cabin, and there's a little.
It's nativity.
It's Joseph Smith nativity scene. Yeah.
My parents are in Vermont on their mission at the Joseph Smith birthplace. I'm sure they'll have it all.
Yeah, I think they wouldn't do that just out. Not to give ammunition to their critics.
They're doing what has been done in
it's
other
natural.
Worlds, right? You know, somebody can point out
veneration
all, you
of
know,
heroes.
How many heroes were born of a virgin birth or born during at the December at the basically the winter equinox, right? The time of greatest darkness, then light emerges. I mean, how many times does that happen over and over again? Unsoiled by sex. You know, you can find these elements over and over and over again, and partly some of them were borrowed. Some of them we just keep stumbling onto, but...
Wait, I don't think anybody's ever claimed that Joseph was unsoiled by sex.
No, but like, what was the...
But quite a few
conference
heroes are.
Talk where he showed up late at the gates of St. Peter or whatever, says, well, I am late, but I am clean. Like, then, oh, see, he made it through. He's fine.
Well, like a lot of heroes will emerge from the side of their mother because then they're unsoiled by the vagina.
Ew,
right?
Come on.
So they have these common elements. So what I think is the point of this podcast, at least the point I'm trying to make, is I never said it would be easy.
I'll second that.
I only said it would be worth it. I haven't fished that for you. Have you ever seen those signs around? Okay. Dude, is that just a Mormon thing?
Yeah, I don't know of it being a Jehovah's Witness thing.
But you had What Would Jesus Do? He would go on a hero's journey.
They don't wear the What Would Jesus Do?
Well, the J stands for Jehovah. So.
Oh, What Would Jehovah Do?
Same bracelet.
That's right.
What sort of control devices do they use on their kids then?
Do they have any special rings or necklaces?
They have like children's books and just nonstop indoctrination. I mean, it's not just once a week. It's like all week long. Of course, it's slowed down now. It's like only three times a week.
So you, my friends out there, all have the divine spark. You all have Buddha nature. You all have it in you to go on the hero's journey. And it will be difficult, and there will be difficult decisions to be made, and things are not clear. But you will emerge as the master of two worlds and as the pilot of your own destiny. And you'll give up like the myth of unending happiness. The myth of heaven.
Is that something that people really want to give up?
No, it's just like giving up the myth of Santa Claus, right? Like, it's this great fiction and it's very comforting, but actually there's a real world and it's your parents that really care about you. And that's somewhat more beautiful than the man at the North Pole.
Right. And what's beautiful about unending happiness? You wouldn't even know it after a while.
That's right. You get used to it.
It'd all feel the same. Bored.
Well, it's Buddha, right before he left,
mundane.
Right before he left the palace, you know, his father had surrounded him with no pain and every pleasure he could have. He had a beautiful wife. He had a beautiful son. He had had as much sex and food and everything. And then the one day he said he wanted to leave the palace. So the king went and scrubbed the city and had everything hidden and all the elderly and everything. And as he's going down, because he wants to see the city, he's 30 years old. He first catches glimpse of, I think
it was a poor man. It's a starving.
It's like a cripple or a sick person.
Yeah.
And he'd never seen that before. And then he, a little while later, he sees an old person. So he'd never encountered the idea. And then I think he sees a dead animal. He encounters death. Sickness, age, and death he encounters. And it's all been hidden from him. And the Buddha then goes back and he gazes upon his beautiful wife, who he loves dearly, and his beautiful child, who he's in love with. He's absolutely in love with his child. And he realizes that this is all an illusion. They all are going to become sick and they're all going to die. That no matter how much we push against it, we're going to lose all of this. And no amount of pleasure walled up in this city is going to stop that fact from being true. So he goes off on the journey to solve the ultimate problems. Right.
So he has to leave his wife and child to ultimately not have to lose them.
To save them. And I think what a lot of Western folks who don't understand Buddhism, they look at that as horror. How could he leave his wife and his child? Because he knew that the path that he was on, walled up in that city, shielded from what was inevitable, living an illusion, was an illusion itself. That he couldn't save them that way. That the salvation lied was elsewhere. And for us all, every one of us who have left the church and come out on the other side, have done so at loss, personal loss, of relationships, of family, of things that were destroyed that can never be regained. But those things were tied to a myth. They were tied to a falsehood. And the truth and the journey towards truth is worth more than that, because we'll never achieve salvation clinging to these illusions inside our palace.
That's very well put.
Wow.
Now I think to where the Buddha ends up, that, you know, he eventually discovers the Four Noble Truths, right? The first is that suffering. Life is suffering. We suffer.
It's inevitable.
And of course the Buddhists go down a path where they start saying, you know, that we have attachment, and so we need to find the right path to break ourselves of attachment.
Because if we aren't attached to anything, we won't have suffering.
The cessation of suffering. Suffering comes from attachment, basically. And I sort of depart ways with them, because as an atheist, I realize that some of what we have is in our DNA. It's our genetics. We like sex because we're programmed to like sex. That's neither good nor bad. You know, it just is. And so you should have as much sex as you can have while managing the consequences. If you follow the campsite rule, that you're not using other people up, you're not causing pain and suffering to them, you're not using yourself up, you're not causing pain and suffering to you, then go ahead, you know. But that suffering, like the Buddha discovered, the First Noble Truth, is real. And we, because of, I believe, our evolution, understand that we are tuned into that. We are empathetic to other human beings. And that can't be escaped except through neurosis, except through psychosis. And once you realize that, then you realize certain things, like religions do a lot to circumvent our natural morality. That every good drill sergeant knows that men, no matter how gung-ho they are when they join the military, have a natural aversion to killing things. And part of basic training is a 9-week program in overcoming that aversion. And that's what big organizations and big religions often are doing, because we naturally have an aversion to taking things away from other people. We naturally have an aversion to killing other people, to locking them in cages. And religions oftentimes collect us together, then have us do things collectively that individually we find morally repugnant. And they allow for that collectivization of immorality. And that's where they're really dangerous. So we talked, you are the heroes now. And it's very difficult still, once you're reemerged, to do that. And we talked about, on that down cycle to the abyss, the people need guides. Luke Skywalker needed Obi-Wan Kenobi, not to tell him, because people don't listen to the truth. They have to be pointed in the right direction.
We don't hear things until we're ready to hear them.
Yeah.
Exactly. So our goal, our aim for all of us is to help others, to be that guy, to ask the right question, to be in the right place, to be Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Right on.
Yeah, no, I feel an obligation to stand up and be counted, at least not hide in the shadows if I disagree with something. Christopher Hitchens said there'll be plenty of time for silence after you die.
Mm.
Yeah. Now's the time to stand up. If somebody's being cruel or if they're doing something immoral or unfair, now's the chance to speak up.
Well,
there's another thing going through that journey. Like when you first take the blue pill or walk through the door, whatever you want to call it, like you're just like blown away by all the lies that you heard or whatever, and then you want to just tell everybody about it. And so, but being a helper, you can't. That's not telling them, exposing it to somebody who hasn't taken the blue pill or who hasn't walked down that road to discover it for themselves is only going to entrench them further.
Yeah.
So it's like you were saying, just like Obi-Wan Kenobi didn't give him the answers. He just kind of like helped him along the way.
Right. Yoda gave answers, but they're always wrong.
If you go watch, they were always backwards.
He always said the wrong thing. You know, if you go,
said the
you
wrong
won't
thing
survive.
He did.
If you go this time, he was always wrong.
And confusing. Maybe that helps.
So yeah, it's worth it. It's important. I think the work that we do to help others is extremely valuable. And one of the saddest things, and I've been there myself, is that the people who know, the people who pass through the journey and find their own peace, in Eastern philosophy again, there are the Buddhas, the enlightened ones, but there are a special kind of saint, the Bodhisattva, or however they, I pull it from old Bali, from Laotian and stuff. These are people who come to the threshold of nirvana. This is what the Buddha did. He had a choice, and he chose to stay in order to help mankind. He could have gone on to nirvana. He could have gone to his cessation, but instead he chose to stick around and help others. And I mentioned this on our last podcast, but it's amazing the number of brilliant, intelligent, thoughtful, helpful people I've met who have left the church, who are now sort of gone, because it is a hard fight, and we're underfunded, and we're underappreciated, and we're seen as the enemies by so many people. But what everyone can provide is so needed. It's so necessary. There is so much pain out there still. There's so many people lost after going through that door to the unknown who are going to turn around and go back to safety. And what they need to be is they need to be helped along to that point of enlightenment, that point of awakening.
Yeah, I don't know how anybody got out of the church prior to the internet.
I know.
Because you were so isolated, right? Like you stumble across this stuff, you start asking hard questions, you read a verse that's like impossible to be moral, and you can't talk to your wife about it, your kids aren't going to get it, who do you even talk to? So you just sort of
stuck.
Man, I'd pity anybody.
And research, what did we do that in libraries in the past?
Well, yeah.
Like, now we just type it in.
Yeah. It's much easier to start on the journey now.
Yeah, no, that's one of those things in social psychology on group conformity. In the presence of a single ally, conformity to the group drops by up to 80%.
Mm-hmm.
Like all you need is one other person in the group to say, "Yeah, I'm not cool with that," and that gives courage to the other people who
were maybe thinking the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Yeah, and I've seen that in my own life. I've told this story before. The last time I was in Sunday school, they were talking about Isaac on the altar. And I said, this isn't right. You can't kill somebody because you hear a voice telling you to kill somebody. And there were many who shouted me down, but there were still others who came to my defense. Who
and maybe others that didn't say anything that were thinking it.
And went home and thought about it, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's ex-Mormonism as the hero's journey. It is. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, the people that I know, the people who I love and I want to hang out now – my world is not defined. I announced earlier, I think I put in a, I wrote a blog or something earlier in the year saying I'm no longer an ex-Mormon. I don't think that way. And that's absolutely true. I don't, I was with some friends the other day and they started breaking into like primary songs or something and they were giggling about it. Those things do not even evade my consciousness. But that's 10 years coming. But there's an underpinning to everything that's of value in my life. There are people who have been through this journey. So it's not where we started that unites us. It's that the people who I love the most have all been through that same journey. We've emerged. And even though, you know, Dustin, you and I started from different places, you know, warring factions in the war in heaven, we ended up in the same place. It didn't matter what it was we believed before. It's that we passed through it.
Once enemies, now brothers.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good point, John. It's not the fact that we used to be Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses that unite us. It's more that we understand the pain of the journey.
Yeah.
Well, and not just the pain of the journey, but we received that transformation. We emerged out of it better.
We recognize the other demigods.
Yes.
No, you learn to see the tricks and the illusions and where you can look to for reliable information, and it's not in arguments from authority, and it's not in arguments from the majority. You know, it's not based on these kind of weird fallacies that are everywhere. They're in our politics, and they're in our news, and they're in our churches, and there's so many flawed ways to get information, and we sort of figured out like what the bullshit artists look like. Where to look for them. That's actually quite a rush to hang around with people who can see that.
Yeah, it's valuable. And we have to now try to build the kind of world we want, because the scary thing is, what does Zeus do to Kronos? Zeus cuts off his cock and stuffs it in his mouth and locks him up, because the one set of gods just replaced the other set of gods. And it is our duty to break that cycle. When we become enlightened, then we need to work in this world to not only rid ourselves of our fearful masters, but not to become fearful masters ourselves. I'm looking at you, Dustin, fearful master.
Yeah, no, never. I'm not even ever close, and I'll never be.
All right. Well,
he's a jack of all trades, master of none.
There it is, yeah.
Any last-minute thoughts? Well, thank you all for taking this journey with me. As always, the discussion continues on our website at mormonexpression.com. You can also find other like-minded demigods in the Mormon Expression VIP Lounge on Facebook, 1,000 strong as of this weekend, and some of the most fascinating people you'll meet in your life. Just search for the Mormon Expression VIP Lounge on Facebook, ask to join, and you will be let in. We desire
let
all
him
to receive
enter.
It.
Or her.
And you can contact us, John at MormonExpression.com, Zilpha at MormonExpression.com, and if you have any message for Brian or Dustin, we'd be happy to pass it on to you. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Bye.